I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is February 8th, 2023. The time is 9:00. Present here is co-chairs Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, and myself, co-chair Wilson. Thank you for being here. Please silence your cell phones and all other electronic devices. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Marta. And the Senate Secretaries, Kelsey Riker from the LAO, for staffing the committee this morning. This is the first meeting this year where we'll be hearing non-budget bills in Senate Finance. We've got two Senate bills on our agenda right now. There aren't very many bills that have come to finance, although in the weeks to come, as bills work their way through the policy committees, we expect to see many more. It's my hope and intention to hear bills throughout the session as they come to our committee. Any bill, big or small, if it has a fiscal note, must come through finance if it's going to pass into law. Having said that, I want the sponsors and the public watching to understand that hearing these bills does not necessarily indicate my intent or the intent of the committee to move these bills forward. Those decisions will be made together by the three co-chairs along with other members of the committee. Are there any questions by the committee members before we get started this morning? If not, the first bill, Senate Bill 25, is on the schedule. Senate Bill 25 is by Senator Coffin, an act related to repealing inactive funds, accounts, and programs. I see Senator Coffin is here today. I'd like to invite him to come up to the table with his aide, Matthew Harvey. Senator Coffin, please. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please join us at the table and put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, Senator James Coffman, District F.
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Coffman.
Go ahead with your presentation, Senator Coffman.
Thank you. To the chair and the committee, it's an honor to be the first bill on the table here. Thank you very much for hearing SB 25. And you will, I'll just go ahead and read the sponsor statement. That's all right. Thank you. SB 25 in its current form is intended to improve performance by reducing administrative cost and complexity associated with maintenance and tracking of accounts that are no longer needed but are still open. The state of Alaska has at various times created special accounts to receive and hold money for certain purposes, but over time, some of those funds become dormant and are no longer needed. This can include filled funds that are not supporting active programs, empty funds that are not supporting active programs, and funds held in trust. Reducing the administrative burden of maintaining unneeded funds is a prime example of the type of incremental continuous improvement that is needed as Alaska faces new fiscal challenges. Alongside this important reduction, SB 25 creates a simple feedback loop which provides decision makers with the necessary tools to reduce other funds as recommended. To find candidates for this reduction, we performed an initial screening of inactive funds. This led to analysis of the financial and statutory basis for 39 existing funds. The analysis and deliberative process revealed 6 funds which are no longer needed for the originally intended purpose and can therefore be closed. Any proceeds can be forwarded to the unrestricted general fund. The specific funds for this action are as listed below. AS 41-35-380, Alaska Historical Commission Receipts Account, AS 26-23-400, Fuel Emergency Fund, AS 44-33-115, Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Unincorporated Rural Community Grant Fund, AS 42-45-020, Rural Electrification Revolving Loan Fund, AS 42-45-040, Southeast Energy Fund, AS 1407-182, Curriculum Improvement and Best Practices Fund. And so thank you, and if it's the will of the chair and the committee, my chief of staff, Matthew Harvey, will go through the sectional analysis.
Any questions of the bill sponsored by members of the committee? If not, Mr. Harvey.
Thank you. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Coffman. Section 1 of SB 25 amends AS 24.20.020 and that adds a requirement for Legislative Finance Division to conduct a review of inactive state accounts and funds at the beginning of each new legislature and to submit an electronic report including recommendations regarding which inactive state accounts or funds should be repealed. The report distribution list is included in this section as well. Section 2 adds a new subsection to AS37.07.020 stating that the governor may act upon the Legislative Finance Division report in Section 1 of SB 25 by submitting legislation in accordance with the report. And Section 3 repeals the statutory authority for the following funds, not supporting current or active programs as mentioned in the sponsor statement. The Curriculum Improvement and Best Practices Fund, Fuel Emergency Fund, the Alaska Historical Commission Receipts Account, the Rural Electrification Revolving Loan Fund, the Southeast Energy Fund, and the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Unincorporated Rural Community Grant Fund.
Any further questions by members of the committee? Some of the funds that were listed or some of the issues that were related to the bill? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious from a policy perspective. Several years ago, we used to always do a reverse sweep and reestablish account balances and multitude of funds, and we haven't been able to accomplish that politically. So we've had to restructure a few accounts. But when I look down here at this list, like the Rural Electrification Revolving Loan Fund, and in particular, the Southeast Energy Fund, were holding accounts. And politically, sometimes there is an endeavor from the rail belt to do an energy enhancement capital investment, and it could be significant. It could be power lines, generation, or what have you. And then to make the allocation for state resources fair for a broader group of Alaskans, particularly make it fair to rural Alaska and their energy needs. They have this account, Southeast Energy Fund, to park funds in. So when a political arrangement or deal is struck to do costly energy enhancements in the rail belt, my constituents in Southeast that wouldn't have the time to put projects together would have an account to put some funds into while they went through the process of design and analysis of a new dam or electrical power line extension. So I'm a little bit concerned that what we're doing policy-wise here and in the event that we may inadvertently put rural Alaska at an economic disadvantage. I was wondering if you could help me with that.
Senator Kaufman, you understand the question? And certainly I have that same concern myself for some of the, being a rural legislator, we've got some of these funds in place that have been used in the past and maybe haven't been used in the recent past, but they have played an important role, and that's the reason they were set up. Mr. Kaufman, Senator Kaufman, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Through the chair and through the chair to, what the intent is to reduce funds that are not needed. And we started with a long list, and there was significant money in them. And as we worked through the list, we found in some cases the purpose that was not, immediately apparent. And the list really shortened, and it may shorten more. The initial reduction of these accounts is one piece of the bill, and that's to be discussed, debated, what can be done now. But the next piece is to create a mechanism whereby we do the review and occasionally delete accounts that aren't being needed or no longer required. The impetus for this bill came from discussions with OMB, and originally the nickname for it, maybe still, is silly funds. So funds that are sitting there on the book, or accounts, rather, that they may be funded, they may not be, but they're just things that you have to step around as you're maintaining the books. And so that's why we just decided to look through what we could reduce at this time and then initiate the mechanism whereby we would, every legislative session is what's recommended, go through and just reduce the line items that can be taken off the register.
So if I hear you right, Senator Kaufman, you're not opposed to either adding to or taking away from the listed six funds that you have on the, in the bill. Is that correct?
To the chair, yes, sir. That's exactly correct. What our intent is to really get it started and then get the mechanism, the maintenance mechanism in place.
Senator Wilson, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just two questions to the bill sponsor. Is there do we know the amount currently that these funds have in them now? And is there a criteria of how long these funds should be enacted before they are removed?
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Wilson, of the accounts we have listed, presently the Fuel Emergency Fund has looks like $22,523.74.
Follow up to Senator Wilson. Senator Bishop.
He asked my question.
Oh, okay. Senator Kaufman, while we're on that, what are other accounts out there that have also have funds in them as well?
Thank you. To the chair, I don't recall the entire long list. We really worked it hard in a previous session, and so we can get that information.
Actually, what I was looking for, of these six here, I mean, $22,000 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but there's still money there. Are there any of these that have any significant amount?
To the chair, no, sir. So the list that we have right now are the net balance is the only one that has funding is the amount that I said previously.
Senator Wilson, you had a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just also, would there be a certain criteria of how long these funds have to be inactive before they're removed? Is it 1 year, 2 years?
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Wilson. We don't have that explicitly noted at this point. That could be an amendment if we want to drive it every 2 years. As far as the criteria, it would be difficult to create a useful criteria for, I believe, but it's more if upon review, if it seems to be an unneeded fund.
Thank you.
Senator Keough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kaufman, maybe a question about sort of the goals and the structure there. The bill language suggests that Legislative Finance Division make recommendations to us about future deletions of funds to delete. And generally, we have Leg Finance analyze, report, provide data, but typically not express their opinions. That we leave that to the folks who get elected. Are there criteria you would suggest they use for making recommendations to us?
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Keough, the funds that we found that could be at least deleted in the assessment that we ran were those that for which maybe the purpose was no longer there. It was self-evident. In some cases, a legislation had repealed its reason for being. So there was a range of reasons. We could perhaps have Alexi Painter come up and give some more information around that review process. As far as the recommendation, I think it's really just it would be more of an observation that these funds are little used and the need for this has gone away because of a subsequent piece of legislation that's repealed the driver for it. It would be more of a set of observations, not so much an opinion. They've repealed this. Thank you.
Senator Merrick.
No question. It was answered. Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
I'd like to take the bill sponsor up on the concept of funding these funds, particularly the Rural Electrification Revolving Loan Fund and Southeast Energy Fund, and put lots of money in there. So that's another way of curing it. Just kind of put a little humor on it. But I am concerned about the potential unleveling of the table when we have a big project in the state and it's concentrated in one area or one corridor, that we have to have some mechanism to make it fair to the other communities, much like when we did and created power cost equalization. You know, if the rural communities got nothing but a one-year benefit out of that when we built the big hydros that will spin power for 100 years, there's just an inequity there. So I think we need to give it some consideration. The inability to protect these funds from the sweep creates some problems as we go forward.
Comment to his concern there. You're not sharing the same concern.
Well, thank you. Through the chair to Senator Steadman and the committee. Again, this list is what the assessment that we ran came up with. And so I would welcome any additions, deductions, but the purpose, the higher level purpose that we're doing is the same as we did with our prior bill to reduce unneeded documents. It just creates a review cycle, and then documents that are no longer needed can be elected for deletion if it makes sense. The same with these accounts. And it's really just a kind of a bookkeeping cleanup tool to help keep our accounts current. If we need it for some purpose, then fine. If we make new ones in the future that then become obsolete, then those can go through this process and get deleted if it makes sense. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kaufman, the concept that you're proposing here, I totally agree with. The comments that I have are in regards to the fuel emergency fund. The way that I look at this fund is that it's a tool in the toolbox. It may not be utilized for 1, 2, or 3 years, but be aware that there are some 200 communities out there, and we do have emergencies regarding the use of that fund. So I have concerns about that fund, and I would view that as a tool that's there in case of emergencies that we can utilize. But the analysis that has been presented by Senator Steadman and Senator Olson, I also have concerns about, and some of these are primarily on the books from my viewpoint on keeping those tools in the toolbox. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Comment to his concern, Senator Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair, we started with a big list, and it was millions of dollars, and as we proceeded, the dollars got smaller, the list got shorter. And because what happened from the discussion was that the constituencies for those accounts appeared. We heard from them. And so that's all part of the process, as is this conversation. And any amendments that may come out of it, again, really the focus is just to create the review mechanism and, you know, the observation coming from Ledge Finance that these seem to be dormant accounts that we can delete if they make sense.
Okay. Any further questions or comments by members of the committee? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to hear from Legislative Finance if there was money to put one into one of these funds, say the Fuel Emergency Fund, if that account was no longer existed, is there another account that we could put that money into that could serve the same purpose?
We'll be calling them up after the sponsor and his chief of staff are finished. But I also have concerns about that. The revolving loan fund is another one that has been at least used in my district in the recent past. And so we just need to look at them. But I thank the sponsor for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Right. Any further questions or comments, Senator Kaufman?
No, sir, other than, again, to just thank the committee and the chair for putting us on the table first. It's an honor to be the first bill heard before this committee. Thank you.
Alexa Painter's in the room, and and the senator's done, we'll have Mr. Painter come on up to talk to us about how they identify these current funds and what can be done, whether they should be considered to be eliminated, and what his office might, what their perspective is on it. He'd also cover some of the fiscal notes and answer any of the questions we have for him. Mr. Painter, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. And I can respond to some of the points brought up about particular funds if the committee, if it's the will of the committee. So there was some discussion of the Fuel Emergency Fund. That the Disaster Relief Fund statute was modified in 2000 to allow fuel emergencies to go through the existing Disaster Relief Fund. So that made it so that there was no reason for a special fuel emergency fund separate from the Disaster Relief Fund. So that fund has not been used since the Disaster Relief Fund was modified in 2000. Another one that was asked about was the Rural Electrification Revolving Loan Fund. So that fund was essentially supplanted by the Electrical Service Extension Fund in the 1990s that served a similar purpose through AEA. And there has been no loan activity in that fund since the newer fund, the Electrical Service Extension Fund, was established. So the use of the fund since then has just been repayment of past loans. All of those loans have been repaid since FY08. There's been no lending activity in that program for, I think, nearly 30 years at this point. Southeast Energy Fund was another one that was brought up. That one was originally capitalized with a portion of the proceeds of the Four Dam Pool project. However, the PCE statute was amended in 1999 to divert that revenue instead to the PCE fund. So there's been no revenue going into the Southeast Energy Fund because of that modification to the PCE statute. So there has not been new funds going into that fund, and there's no existing source of revenue. So I can speak a little about the genesis of some of these funds, because Senator Kaufman said it was an OMB project. That was actually during my time at OMB, so that was partially my doing. But a lot of what we were looking at are funds that had no ongoing source of revenue. So, you know, they may have been created at a period of time with an initial capitalization or with an ongoing source, and then statutes were subsequently changed so that there was no longer a use for the fund. A lot of the times when that happens, the fund cannot be repealed at the time because there's outstanding activity in that fund still. So the example would be that Rural Electrification Revolving Loan Fund. There were still repayments happening for decades after the fund was used last, or over a decade, so they couldn't repeal it back when it was first, you know, rendered obsolete. So the, going back now would just be kind of cleaning it up, because there is a program that serves the same purpose that utilities have found more useful. Sometimes the initial review, there were funds that we thought perhaps could be repealed, but there was still some activity. For example, there's a mining revolving loan fund that hasn't taken on new loans since the 80s, but there's still a single property that is foreclosed on that is still belonging to that loan fund. Until that's disposed of, that loan fund can't be repealed. There's a number of stories like that where there's funds that may not have been used for a long time and the original purpose is long gone, but there's some reason why we can't yet repeal it. These were the ones, I think, after the review and in the other body last session, that really there's no ongoing source of revenue, there's no current program or likely future program that could recreate them. The committee or the legislature could create, you know, add money to a fund outside the original statutory revenue flow. A lot of these are sweepable funds, however, so if you did that, then they would be subject to the CBR sweep. So if you didn't reverse that sweep, the funds would go away. So I hope that's helpful.
Senator Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Director Painter. Similar question to the sponsor. Is there a time frame that you would recommend that if one of these funds, like you said, the mining loan fund, that properties disposed of, how many years or a time frame that would be standard best practices that we should get rid of those funds, or that you would recommend to this committee?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think I'm not sure that there would be a single answer to that. I think we would probably be looking towards whether there is any ongoing activity in the fund or prospect for refilling the fund in the case of some of these that had a revenue source. So if we finally paid off that last loan, you can go ahead and repeal that fund that hasn't been used immediately. You don't have to wait another decade. But there may be other funds that were created through appropriation, and there may be a reason to wait because the legislature may wish to appropriate those again. I'm not sure that we would have a particular rule for that, but I think we would be certainly sensitive to the legislature's potential desire to reuse a fund that served a purpose at one point, as long as it hasn't been supplanted by another fund.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Community Grant Fund, that's exhausted now?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that one is. So there were two Exxon Valdez funds. There was the one that we're more familiar with now, which is the civil fund. That's the one that still has activity. And then there was the criminal penalties that went into this other fund. And those penalties were granted out to unincorporated communities that were impacted by the oil spill. Those funds were completely granted out, and there's no funds remaining. That's completely separate from that ongoing civil fund that we still see activity in today.
Follow up, Senator Bridger.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if we go down the road and delete these funds, because some of us have always looked at the Southeast Energy Fund as a potential parking garage, because we've looked at for years some big electrical or energy projects in the rail belt, and clearly to do our hydros it takes a decade to move through that, so we can't respond in a year. So do you have any recommendations for us for a parking garage in the event that we decide to spend billions into the rail belt corridor, where the folks in my district can park a piece of the action so we can actually get some hydros built over, which may take a decade? Is there any mechanisms like that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So one option would be to amend this fund to create a new source of revenue for it rather than an obsolete source of revenue. You could have an ongoing source of revenue that would provide funds into it now. So if there were an investment in a new project, perhaps a portion of that revenue, just as it was originally funded with a portion of the four dam pool as an equity measure, you could do that with a new project. If there were a new rail belt project, you could divert a portion of that revenue to that fund. That would be one option. Another would be to, put those funds in a non-sweepable account that doesn't have a designated purpose. If it's in a sweepable account, as the committee is well aware, there's a risk that the next year your funds won't still be there. We've often used the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation account because that's held outside the general fund and is not considered sweepable, but that does not have a designated purpose. So I would probably, if we made a particular investment in a project and there was a desire for regional balance, I would probably recommend modifying that statute rather than repealing it, perhaps, or creating a new fund with a new revenue source.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Painter, I guess one of the questions I have for you is it's kind of unusual that we get a recommendation from Ledge Finance as to what funds are what's going to be happening to the separate funds that are out there. And in my 20 years of being here or so, that I guess it's the unusualness kind of caught my attention. And because of that, I guess I'm asking you the question, is that an unfair concern? But put in the context that you were there when many of these funds were created, when you were working for OMB a number of decades ago, that adds, I guess, credibility and certainly has the institutional knowledge of why these funds were put in place and what the potential was back then and what they could be today.
Charleston, I wasn't working for OMB decades ago. That was in 2020 when I did the review. I was not there when these were created. But I can speak to, maybe it's a sign of mission creep for our division, but the indirect expenditure report since 2014 has given us the responsibility, which I think is, if you read the statute here, it's right above this new one, that gives us the duty to make recommendations on indirect expenditures and whether those should be repealed. So this is following in line with that current duty. Again, that's not a duty that we perhaps had before, but we've had some recommendation duties since 2014.
So you're comfortable with it?
Chair Olson, yes, I suppose. I think to some degree we're a little uncomfortable with making policy recommendations at all, but it is something that we do currently in a limited fashion. We kind of have to be very careful to specify that we're, with the indirect expenditure report, we're really only looking at whether items are following legislative intent. We're not really making policy recommendations outside of, you know, that this is not what the legislature intended with this item. In these cases, we would probably have a pretty limited scope looking at funds that are truly have been superseded or have no ongoing use. If you had, you know, an entity doing this that had a bit more of a free rein, they may have more recommendations for deletion than we would. We would probably be pretty conservative to avoid, you know, overstepping our bounds.
Sure. Okay. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, who determines which funds are sweepable and how firm, you know, how firm is that list? Is it subject to change? And if so, how does it change?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick. The statute that the legislature passed that determined what funds are sweepable was ruled unconstitutional in the 1990s. So since then, essentially, it's been up to legal interpretations of the constitutional or that Supreme Court decision. The sweep is executed by the Division of Finance in the Department of Administration. So that division is responsible for ultimately executing it. So it's the executive branch's interpretation of that. That interpretation has changed as new legal opinions come out, because there's not a current statute that puts the legislature, you know, our opinion on the books, because our statute was ruled unconstitutional.
Any further questions by a member of the committee? Director Painter, there is one fiscal note. Do you want to make a comment on that and how it came about, just to see what your perspective is on it?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have a zero fiscal note for this bill. It does create a new duty of our division, but we believe that we could handle that duty with existing resources. Similar to the indirect expenditure report, we did not have to hire a new analyst. Although, actually, I think we did. I was hired as a new analyst in 2014 for the indirect expenditure report, and we did get money then. In this case, I think we're at the same staffing level that created, and we will probably continue to maintain that staffing level.
Okay. With that, thank you very much. And if there's no further questions of Director Painter, we'll go ahead and let him go back to his seat. I'd like to call that in for a step. Sir. Call the Senate Committee back, Senate Finance Committee back to order. At this time, we'd like to call for public testimony if there is any. Do we have any public testimony either in the building or online? No? No public testimony, so we'll close public testimony. If there's no further questions, Senator Kaufman, you want to come up and talk? Or say any closing comments before we set this bill aside?
Thank you. For the record, Senator James Kaufman, District F. Through the chair, all I have to say is thank you, and I appreciate the questions today. And if there's any amendments or suggestions to improve the bill, I welcome that and look forward to it. So just once again, thank you for having this hearing.
Thank you for coming before the committee. With that, we'll take an at-ease. Let's get ready for the next one. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. The next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 38 by Senator Wilson, an act relating to interference with emergency communications. We heard this bill in the committee last year. It eventually passed the Senate, but it didn't quite make it through the finish line on the other body. After Senator Wilson introduces the bill, we will have invited testimony from Public Safety Commissioner James Cockrell, who's in the building, followed by Mr. Joel Butcher, the Association of Public Safety Communication Officials. Senator Wilson, wouldn't walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the Finance Committee for hearing Senate Bill 38. For the record, I'm Senator David Wilson, Senator for District N. 911 is a service that we often take for granted. Whether you call one time or a thousand times, one of those 911 operators must answer that phone. Abuse of the 911 line is an issue that is bogging down the system. These operators are caring and incredibly hardworking. It's frustrating for them to repeatedly answer calls when no emergency exists. These calls severely impact public safety and emergency response by delaying the response of real emergencies. Dispatchers must put these callers with genuine emergencies on hold sometimes to answer a repetitive harasser. For example, you may have a child that may be choking, you may be operating a search and rescue call, and you get a caller that calls 80 times to harass, to cuss out, or threaten an operator. And the operator must answer that 911 call. This bill, Senate Bill 38, addresses that issue by making those behaviors a crime. This bill makes it clear that this is a crime to call 911 repeatedly if there's no new emergency and the emergency dispatcher has asked that caller to stop. It's also a crime to call 911 repeatedly when there is no knowing that there is no real emergency, and it is a crime to threaten a 911 operator during a call. In the past, law enforcement has attempted to use other statutes such as harassment, false reporting, disorderly conduct to stop the interference when this occurs. Often, these efforts are dismissed by prosecuting attorneys because of the ambiguity of the statutes. This bill takes away that ambiguity. This bill has been supported, and I believe there are letter supports inside your files from the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, the Alaska Joint Chapter of the National Emergency and Number Association, and the Association of Public Safety Communication Officials, Anchorage Police Department, Anchorage Police Department Employee Association, Bristol Bay Police Department, City of Wasilla, the Mat-Su Borough, the Alaska Municipal League, and the Wasilla Police Department Employee Association. With that, Mr. Chair, if it's the will of the committee, I do have Ms. Jasmine Martin here, my trustee staff, to go over the sectional, and we also have folks from that you mentioned earlier to provide invited testimony.
Ms. Martin, please. Go ahead.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Quick sectional, just two sections to this bill. The first section is all new language. It adds language to AS 1156, our criminal law's offense against the public administration statutes. And it, for the first part, establishes what this behavior is that's becoming a crime. So calling 911 to elicit a first responder response for previously reported incident after a 911 operator has instructed you to stop calling. Second behavior, making repeated 911 calls when there's no emergency. And the third behavior is to threaten a 911 operator during the course of a 911 call. Second part of this section, section part B here, defines emergency communication center, and emergency communication worker. These definitions were pulled from the National Emergency Numbers Association's definitions. And then the third part, part C here, establishes that this crime is a Class B misdemeanor. And then the second section, just as the saving clause, add the section of uncodified law that specifies that just only applies to behavior after this act is enacted. Thank you. That concludes the sectional.
Any questions of the either the bill sponsor or the his chief of staff? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wilson, for the listening audience, what communities have the 911 call, and are they municipal or are they 911 calls to a statewide switchboard.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we have some regional dispatchers that are contracted. For example, MAPCOM handles the city of Wasilla, but they also handle the detachment C for the Matsu Borough for the troopers as well. And there are other regional call centers throughout the state. I believe Kenai is another one that handles sort of that region. I'm not sure if Southeast also goes to MAPCOM or no. We're not sure on that, but I believe the commissioner is from DPS is here, and he could probably give a little bit more detail upon his other operational dispatch call centers throughout the state.
Follow-up, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll wait for the commissioner to respond. I also have another question for the commissioner, so he may think about it. And that was an incident where an airplane crashed in Cook Inlet, and there was a 911 call made, but it was dispatched all the way up to Fairbanks, and it was not successfully responded to, which resulted in a death. But I would like to see how that was rectified. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly, Senator Wilson, as a pilot myself and having somebody going down in the water, it was a very troubling incident that still plagues me to this day. Senator Stedman. Okay, Senator Wilson, if you're finished, our first invited testifier is going to be Commissioner Cockrell from the Department of Public Safety, who's in the room. Commissioner, welcome to the Senate Finance. Please come forward and put your name on the record and give your testimony, and we'll have questions after you testify. Commissioner Cockrell.
For the record, James Cockrell, Commissioner of Department of Public Safety. And through the chair, I just want to thank you for your willingness to let me testify. I'll make this fairly quickly. First of all, the Department of Public Safety certainly supports this legislation. The department and other dispatch centers around the state has to have a mechanism to provide, I guess, support to our dispatchers. And when we have individuals calling 911 multiple times, usually it's because they're mad at a law enforcement officer or actions that were taken or weren't taken. It ties up the dispatchers. It adds more stress to it. But also, it interferes with more 911 calls coming into the dispatch centers and could slow down or even prevent a response to a real emergency. So this is a way for us to at least be able to have a tool to even threaten a person who continues to call 911 and say, you know, you're committing crime. If you don't stop calling us, we will send the troopers out or the local police department out to potentially arrest you. And hopefully that will be a deterrence, because right now we don't have that deterrence. I don't see us making a lot of cases. I mean, it certainly happens a lot, but I think with this tool and this ability to warn somebody that they're breaking the law will help deter further people or that same individual continue to call us. So bottom line is we're completely supportive of it. We have one big dispatch center in Fairbanks, and I think Senator Hoffman asked about other dispatch centers. The troopers are also dispatched on contract for the Matsu, MATCOM or Matsu Borough, and then on the Kenai Peninsula, our dispatch services are contracted out to the Kenai Peninsula Borough.
Any questions by members of the committee? Go ahead, Mr. Hoffman. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How are the 911 dispatches addressed in the major hubs in rural Alaska, such as Unalaska, Dillingham, Bethel, Kotzebue, Nome?
Through the chair, I believe each of those communities that you mentioned have their own dispatch centers. Areas outside of Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor. And those are trunk line to our Fairbanks Dispatch Center, the 911.
And I understand that in the past, Bethel had its 911 dispatch operated by the Bethel Police Department, but they switch over when they're not there to the statewide or the troopers to respond to 911. Is that the case today?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I have to check up on that. I do not know that question right now.
I would like to have that question answered, because in many areas in rural Alaska, they don't have the finance. I know this is indirectly related to this bill, but it's important from a service standpoint, because many of those rural areas don't have the necessary finances to have a 911 dispatch, but that does not mean that there is a need, maybe even greater need for 911 access for residents in rural Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
To the chair, if I can attempt to answer that. First of all, the department acknowledges the struggles and the challenges we have providing 911 service to a lot of our communities in rural Alaska. Like I've said, 911 calls that are made in Kotlik or some of the other villages in your region will go through a trunk line to our Fairbanks office, Fairbanks Dispatch Center. The issues that we have there is the fact that once it's trunk line, that we don't have the actual telephone number or even the location where the phone call was originated, because it goes through the trunk line. And that's something the department is focused on trying to alleviate. The only way we'll be able to alleviate that issue is to have cooperation from the telecommunication companies. And that's a big expensive lift for them, and apparently they haven't been very forthcoming in trying to upgrade their towers to phase two before we get a lot better information on a 911 call.
And to follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, I know it's indirectly related, but after the request has been made, the more important factor is getting services out to Kotlik, for instance, that the commissioners mentioned, to rectify the problem. That, I think, needs to be looked at as well. I know that there's the governor has included additional troopers to many areas in the state, but not necessarily placing them in rural areas of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any comments? Commissioner Cockrell?
Through the chair, you know, I guess my comment is that the department is focused on putting more troopers in rural areas and specifically more smaller communities. We'll continue to do that as long as I'm commissioner. I'm committed to that. I know that we have logistical issues that we haven't overcome, housing, for instance. I mean, we have put troopers in Hooper Bay. We have put troopers in Selawik, Imani. And we're continually looking at other areas. I'd like to put my priority right now is Stebbins, St. Michael's, because they've certainly have stepped up and said they want a trooper there. Now we're just trying to come up with the trooper and, more importantly, the housing. I mean, we're certainly focused on rural Alaska, and I'm committed to it. It's not happening as quickly as I'd like it to happen, though.
Commissioner Cocker, we want to thank you for your efforts to try and put first-line law enforcement people out there. But as we look at that 911 call, the troopers may respond, may not respond. What role do the VPSO have in the whole mix of somebody that calls in from a 911 from places like Kotlik or Savunga or someplace like that?
Well, through the chair, as you know, the VPSO program is important to the department, extremely important. Currently, we have all our VPSO positions filled. Mm-hmm. We're at 68. I think we were at 45 just less than a year and a half ago. And we're continuing to try to build that program. The VPSOs are not only law enforcement, but they do many other things within our villages. And if there is a 911 call into one of the villages that we have a VPSO, that either the dispatch center or the trooper in Bethel or Noam Kotzebue will call that VPSO to respond to the incident that's going on. Usually the VPSO that live in those communities will know if there's an emergency going before we even get the call in Fairbanks or wherever else we get the call from.
Okay. One of the questions I have for you, and maybe this is more of a question for the bill sponsors, what percentage of the calls are more harassment rather than true emergencies? So you just give us a perspective. You must get hundreds or if not thousands of calls every day or every week, but there's certainly an annoying portion, not just an annoying portion, a portion that tends to go ahead and disrupt the whole 911 service.
To the chair, I don't have that information. Like I said, I don't think we would see a lot of additional cases. But I will say when that does happen, it's very disruptive to the dispatch center and potentially could slow down emergency responses to that center and then to first responders to whatever emergency it is. That's what's so can be disastrous if we have somebody that is tying up the line, especially in our smaller dispatch centers where they don't have more consoles than, say, MATCOM or the Kenai Peninsula or our dispatch center in Fairbanks.
And Commissioner Cockrell, as you're trying to crack down on some of these people who have complaints and are doing things that are non-emergent, I guess what's your capability to go and figure out where they're at? Because the former commissioner of public safety 25 years ago or so had an issue at his house and they couldn't find where the and because of that, there was two fatal situations there. How confident you can find some of these places that make phone calls to 911?
To the chair, that's a great question. I know that technology has really improved since that occurrence, and certainly the Anchorage Bowl area is increased there. If it comes from a landline, we're very certain where that call is made from. But nowadays, with the use of cell phones, it makes it a little bit more difficult. We'll have the telephone number, but we may not have the location because it's coming from a cell phone versus a landline.
Senator Stidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you help me a little bit how this bill helps, or if there's other mechanisms you have for just prank calls when someone calls up to send the responders to the other direction in town and there's nothing out there? How do you deal with those, not multiple calls, but just prank calls?
Well, again, if prank calls, if we're able to find out who actually made the phone call, I mean, again, we might be able to charge them, but under this bill, we would be able to charge them for responding or sending, say there's a fire somewhere, there's not a fire, and all the fire department goes there. And it does happen. The hard part is trying to find the person, but if we do, at least this will give us a mechanism to charge it, because right now I'm not sure that we'd be able to.
Bob, Senator Stidman. Oh, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, sir.
So could you, if let's say this bill was to pass, how are you going to find out who's making? Are you going to put a trace on their call and immediately if this is dispatcher recognizes this as a repeat offender? How are you going to find them?
Well, through the chair, and I know that we'll have some experts that actually work in the dispatch center, so maybe ask that to them. But
okay.
Senator Bishop, I know that a lot of times the frequent caller that will disrupt dispatch centers, we already know who they are.
All right.
In a lot of such situations.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Commissioner Cockrell by members of the committee? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I asked earlier, there was a situation out a few years ago in Cook Inlet where a smaller craft went down, and they called 911, and as I understand it, that 911 call went up to Fairbanks and was not relayed to the vicinity that where the incident occurred that resulted in the pilot being a fatality of the pilot. And I'm wondering, has that been corrected and how has that been rectified?
Commissioner Hoffman, please.
Chair, I have a little bit of knowledge of that. I think that happened 6 or 7 years ago. I'd have to refresh myself. I know the phone call was made on a satellite phone, which ended up not going to MATCOM, which would have been normal if it was a normal phone or a cell phone at the time, and ended up going to Fairbanks. And then somehow, and again, I don't have good information because it's been a while and I wasn't involved in that. The call didn't get transferred to MATCOM fast enough, and the pilot ended up perishing, and I don't know if there's been changes in technology or if we've changed procedures on that.
Bob, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to see if you or someone could see if that has been rectified, and if not, how can it be rectified? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Cockrell?
Through the chair, I'll look into it.
Thank you very much. There's no further questions of Commissioner Cockrell.
Thank you.
We
We will take it at ease at this point. Well, Senate Finance Committee back to order. Since there's no further questions of the Commissioner, our next testifier is Mr. Joe Butcher. Mr. Butcher, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
For the record, my name is Joel Butcher. I reside in Palmer, Alaska. For full disclosure, I work for the City of Wasilla at the MATCOM Dispatch Center, the tech support specialist. I'm the president of the Alaska Joint Chapter of AFCO and NENA. For those that may not be familiar with these professional organizations, AFCO is the Association of Public Safety Communications Officials, and NENA is the National Emergency Number Association. Our chapter membership includes 160 emergency services dispatchers, support personnel, and radio technicians across the state of Alaska. We support this legislation as there is no current state statute that addresses or criminalizes this type of activity specifically. When this type of activity occurs, it degrades the service that the Communications Center provides to others, taking time away from real emergencies that may be occurring at the same time. This legislation is not about criminalizing someone that calls 911 in error. This is giving dispatchers and 911 call takers the ability to cite a statute warning the caller of the behavior and provides law enforcement a statute to arrest someone as a last resort to stop the negative impact that the activity is having on the communication center. I urge you to support this legislation and to add a little bit. MATCOM in January 2023 received about 3,232 911 calls. Of those, 731 911 calls were identified as a accidental misdial or inadvertent dial of 911 and required follow-up to determine whether or not a actual emergency exists. So when you compound those normal numbers by somebody that's calling 30 or 40 times to disrupt the activity is tremendous. And Mr. Chair, welcome any questions from your committee.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Butcher? So, Mr. Butcher, one of the questions that I have was, I'd asked before Commissioner Cockrell, but since you're the communications person here, what's the percentage of people that are actually misusing the system and using it in a detrimental way that ties up a line which could be used for emergencies that are ongoing?
So, from past to the chair, past experiences have usually occurred when somebody repeatedly calls and is asked to stop calling the 911 center and in all of the areas that this statute addresses, they're told to stop calling, they have no new emergency, they're upset or in a mental state where they don't have anything else to do or any other application to vent their frustration on. So it occurs rarely, but when it does occur, it's usually at the most inopportune time for that activity to increase its disruptive power on the dispatch center. In the past, we've been working on towards this legislation for a number of years. It started probably back about 4 years ago with a particular individual that called repeatedly, and they didn't rise to the level of a threat. Once they did, the individual dispatcher had to become the victim, and charges were pursued on the threat level. But I would say it happens probably a couple, 2 to 3 times a year with our dispatcher center alone.
So, Mr. Butcher, if I'm hearing you correctly, of the 3,200 phone calls that you got, 231 were accidental. There's only one or two of those that are eventually become involved in some type of a threat or some menace to the system?
To the chair, there was 731 accidental misdials in the month of January 2023 to the MACOM Dispatch Center. None of those calls rose to that level and were all dealt with without if the statute were in place, that statute probably would not have been used in those 731 misdials that we received in January.
Mr. Butcher, if I can continue on, as you look at other states, what have they done to try and stop these phone calls that are interfering with the normal 911 reasons it was put in place?
To the chair, there's approximately 23 states that have similar statutes. I polled after the last hearing our professional group and came up with statutes from 7 specific states, and I could list those off if you'd like. Nice. And forward them to the committee if you'd like. They're basically statutes from Iowa, Tennessee, Connecticut, Texas, Georgia, Florida, and California.
Mr. Butcher, how effective have these statutes been in stopping this kind of illegal activity?
To the chair, the respondents to my question to the group indicate that they're effective and they are being used to charge individuals, whether it's teenagers that are calling 911 and not saying anything, and then they hang up and then they call back, and those silent 911 calls, people have been charged with, and I think that the main purpose in what we want is we want the ability to say you're in violation or could be in violation of state law if you continue to call, and we will have a officer or trooper contact you if you continue to call. That's the main tool that the dispatch center is looking for out of this legislation, if that answers the question, sir.
Yes, sir. I just want to know how effective they've been, and sound like they have been fairly effective in deterring that kind of behavior. Any further questions?
Chair, I believe so.
Any further questions by members of the committee for Mr. Butcher? If not, we want to thank you for coming and testifying this morning. And so thank you for your testimony. We'll go on to public testimony now. We're done with our invited testimony. Do we have any public testimony that's there? No public testimony? Anybody in the room that wants to testify? If not, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. The next thing I'd like to do, Senator Wilson, is do you have somebody to go ahead and present the fiscal notes that are there? There are 5 of them. You want to do it, or do you want your staff to do it? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can.
Or you're not prepared to this?
No, I can go through the notes here.
All right.
Senator Bishop.
Through Chair. two questions of the bill sponsor before he leaves.
For sure, let's do that. Senator Bishop, please.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jasmine, what constitutes a threat and against an operator, and is that defined in statute? That's question number one.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, through the chair to Senator Bishop. Threat is defined in AS 1181-900, and it is essentially pulled from the definition of extortion. So if you look under the extortion statutes, there's a long list of what a threat constitutes.
Follow up?
Senator Bishop, please.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask the question if you don't know if you can get back to the committee, but does the Class B misdemeanor apply to minors as well?
Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. I do not know off the top of my head. Senator Wilson is nodding his head there, though.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, those would also apply to the judicial code, applies to minors and to adults.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you.
No further, no follow-up? Okay, if there's no further question by members of the committee, we'll go through the fiscal notes. Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the first fiscal note, one, from OMB component 43, has a total operating of $225,000 from UGF fund source 104. This is from the Department of Administration, Appropriation, Legal Advocacy Service, the allocations, the Office of Public Advocacy. They're saying that this bill creates new Class B misdemeanors, which prohibits a person from repeatedly contacting emergency services, new crimes and workload from the Office of Public Advocacy. They say the agency is unable to absorb any new cases without because of the trial suspensions of the response of COVID-19. And because of their unprecedented recruitment and retention challenges facing the public advocacy, they are requesting additional attorney for this note. Second note, physical note two, is also from the Department of Administration, Legal Advocacy, Public Defenders Agency, the allocation, OMB component 1631, for a total operating of UGF of $205,000. Same analysis is that this bill would create new additional workload for the public defender agency, and they're unable to absorb any new cases because of the trial suspensions and backlog due to COVID-19, because of the unprecedented recruitment and retention challenges facing the public agencies case-wide, and so they need are requesting another position, Mr. Chair. Physical note number three is a zero note from Department of Corrections, Population Management, and allocation of OMB component 1381. They believe that since this is a new offense, the department has no historical data and able to determine how many convictions will occur under the statute, and so therefore a zero note is submitted for this legislation. Physical note number four, from the Department of Law Criminal Division, OMB component 2202 has a zero note, Mr. Chair. They said this is a emergency communications Class B misdemeanor. It's unclear how many additional cases the criminal division will prosecute if this bill were to pass. However, the targeted conduct is very specific. Therefore, the department does not anticipate any potential increases in cases that will have a physical impact. And the last note, Mr. Chair, is physical note number five from the Department of Public Safety, Alaska State Troopers, Allocation Dispatch Services, OMB component 3346, also has a zero note. This law does not address, current laws do not currently address the specific behavior of personnel under the harassment, but having a specific statute addressing these calls to interfere with emergency communications will help dispatchers focus on doing their job to assist legitimate emergencies, and they say that there is no physical impact to the Department of Law. And that is the five physical notes, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you very much for going over those. Senator Houghton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The current version of Senate Bill 38, is this identical to the one that passed out of this committee?
Senator Wilson.
We made one small technical change to take away, I believe, to clean up some language that was recommended from the Department of Law, but it's pretty much identical in terms of the statute and the for that. So we did change one thing, and I believe Ms. Martin can probably give a little bit more detail into that.
That's fine. On the fiscal notes, Senator Wilson, are fiscal notes number one and number two different than fiscal notes in the previous legislation?
Yes.
Before you answer that question, there's Rob Carpenter. He's in the audience here, and we'll be calling him up after a minute here, after you have your response to Senator Hoffman's question, to answer some of the questions that came out of the department.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Hoffman. Yes, we had a zero note from the Department of the Department of Administration, from the Division of Office of Public Advocacy. This note is identical to three other notes. They were just saying that because of the previous hearing that we heard, because the bill package that we passed last year was not passed with the physical notes for the increase in that division, every bill that they see, they are attaching the same description, the same number, numerics, no matter the impact to the division. It is to note that this is just a misdemeanor and no felonies, and the largest municipality that will probably handle most of these is the municipality of Anchorage, and they handle all misdemeanor crimes, so the Department of Public Advocacy would not be impacted in terms of those type of cases. And so we've asked for additional analysis to see if it's one case or five cases, but they said that they stand by their notes and they are unwilling to provide any in-depth analysis to this note. And so that brings us some concern upon other notes through that department.
All up, Senator Hoffman.
No additional questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions of the bill sponsor or his chief of staff by members of the committee? If not, Mr. Carpenter, if you would kind of come up and comment on the fiscal notes that are there. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars here. So because of that, we at the Finance Committee want to know what the administration's perspective is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob Carpenter, Legislative Finance, members of the committee. I guess I was asked to, we at Ledge Finance look at every fiscal note that is attached to a bill that comes through the Finance Committees. I can't really speak to, I shouldn't question necessarily that these agencies are short supplied in attorneys and resources. However, I think you've heard from the testimony and every other fiscal note attached to this bill that the fiscal impact is minimal and indeterminate at best. So I would argue that requesting funding for a minimal fiscal impact when it's really other issues that are addressing the agency is probably inappropriate, and they should go through a regular budget process to deal with those to get that kind of money and the attorneys they say they need.
Any other questions of Mr. Carpenter by members of the committee? Not one. Thank you for your honest opinion of what's going on there, and we tend to agree with you.
All right. Thank
with
you.
With that, thank you very much for coming up. Senator Wilson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And we understand that, there is a cost to the state, and we're okay with having a bill have a cost to the state, especially to deal with these emergency situations. I just want to state, one situation that we did not get on record in this committee. One of our testifiers is out of town, out of reach. Talks about a case that happened in Big Lake where we had a drowning happen on the 4th of July weekend. And we had over 80 calls from a harasser that really impacted the search and rescue's efforts for that community. Unfortunately, that did result in the loss of life. But who knows what could have happened if we could have gotten there sooner, faster, and more coordinated response without the harasser making those phone calls. And this is really just for deterrent. We're not trying to criminalize and arrest, tens of, hundreds of folks. But it is just a tool in the toolbox for the dispatcher to say this is a crime, and or to just have an officer knock on the door and maybe just do a welfare check on an individual. Maybe there is another situation happening that they just need to have a welfare check or another crisis intervention other than an arrest occur, but this is just one of those tools in the toolboxes to help mitigate. This intention is not to try to criminalize or trying to institutionalize individuals, but just making sure that we have the appropriate response for the appropriate situation.
Okay. One of the questions I do have is, how do you go ahead and try and separate those people that have got either behavioral health or mental health issues that are have 911 on their speed dial or something like that, where they're sometimes the elevator just doesn't go to the top floor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is a question that we get a lot on this piece of legislation. This bill actually gives the tool to send a trooper out or a first responder out to this to an individual's house to do, like I said, do those checks. And we passed a piece of legislation last year, House Bill 174, that begins that crisis intervention that you hear from the mobilization, so they can be able to send maybe a trooper or a police officer goes out to the home and they see that there is some other issues going on. We can send a mobile crisis response team out to them to make sure that they are being taken care of. And that's the intent of that, so that, you know, police officers can do what they're doing and go back to their, what they're trained to do, and have a mental health, behavioral health specialist intervene at that time to make sure that person's getting the proper help.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. Any further questions of the bill sponsor or anybody else on this bill? If not, we're gonna set this Senate Bill 38 aside for now. We'll continue to hear bills throughout the session. So make sure you watch the calendar. This concludes our agenda for today. Tomorrow, Senator Sedman will be having the gavel again. We will hear from the Department of Education and Early Development with an update on the school construction and major maintenance needs. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 10:20 p.m. or a.m.